This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This has been a crazy week for the economy in America and in markets around the world. Monday recorded the steepest drop within a single day that the Dow Jones Industrial Average has ever experienced, and there are problems like that happening in markets all over the world. The world economy is extremely jittery right now. Now, if you watch the economists on television, they're telling you, don't worry about it. It's all going to be fine. Do you believe them? Should you believe what they're saying? We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Robert Morley about making sense of this economic roller coaster. If you have ever heard or read the message of Herbert W. Armstrong, you are almost certainly familiar with the dramatic forecasts that he made about Europe. Now, this was a high-profile speaker on television and radio over a period of many decades. Over 8 million copies of his Plain Truth News magazine were sent out each month. A lot of people are familiar with what he said over the years. For over 50 years, he said that Europe was going to unite, that it would come together politically, that it would have a single currency, that it would emerge as the major power in the world. And he even said before Germany united, he said Germany would unite and it would be at the head of this entity. Now, those forecasts are reality in the news today. We're seeing it more and more. And in the program today, we're going to focus on a paper published by a European think tank that gives us an idea of where Europe is headed, how it's going to fulfill those prophecies even more in the time ahead. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the extraordinary conclusions brought out in this policy report. The KPCG radio lineup is about to have a new member of the family. A program called Live by Every Word starts next Tuesday, September 1st at 8 a.m. Now, a lot of people talk about the Bible, but they don't really know much about it. A lot of people criticize it, but it's really because they misunderstand it. This new show aims to help you clear up those misunderstandings and to get to know your Bible better so that you can have confidence in using it to guide your life. It's going to be hosted by a good friend of mine, an excellent Bible instructor at Herbert W. Armstrong College, Brian Davis. We're going to talk with him about this program and why you're going to want to make this a part of your week. And I'll conclude the program today with a word about the importance of literally sticking together with your mate. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past Monday, when Wall Street opened, the Dow Jones plunged 1,300 points in 3 minutes, the sharpest drop within a day ever recorded. Now, things recovered somewhat as the day went on, but it shows just how jittery the world economy is. China's stock market has been in deep trouble. It's sending markets all over the world into trouble. And now, ever since this time, politicians and economists, they've been all over television saying, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. This is good. This is healthy. We need these market corrections. Is it true? Robert Morley is here to help us make sense of what's going on here. They're saying this isn't a big deal, right? But are they right?
Yeah, they're absolutely making that case. And as you mentioned, when the market went into free fall on Monday, as if on cue, the talking heads were trotted out all over television, convincing people, now's the time, go out, buy more stocks. Buy more stocks. They're going to get them on sale today.
I mean, you really have to have a pretty tough stomach to do that under those conditions.
Yeah, well, as you said, that was the biggest drop that the Dow's experienced in its history. If you took a take a look at what happened on the previous Friday and then what happened on Monday, 2 days in a row, the Dow closed down 500 points. It's never done that ever before. So these are some pretty dramatic happenings that are going on in the market right now.
The idea that this is healthy, what's the logic behind that assertion?
Well, I think a lot of it just gets down to that sometimes there can be speculation built up into the market. And if you're an investor, you don't want to be buying an investment that has, you know, the extra premium on it because of speculation or a short-term trend. So when things do sell off, There has, I mean, if you look at the Dow throughout history, if you would have bought the down dips, it has recovered every time. And just a couple of months ago, it was trading at 18,000, which is a new record high for the Dow. We're down 10% from that now. But in the big scheme of things, it's actually, we're not down all that much.
Because of speculation, there has to be corrections. But you're suggesting that this is more than just, kind of a healthy correction.
I think there's a good chance this could be something, the start of something very big. If you look at the volatility index, it's commonly called the fear gauge.
Yeah, help us to understand what people are thinking as they're watching this going on.
Right. So when the markets opened up on Monday, the CBOE, it has this volatility index. It basically,
CBOE is what?
The CBOE is a Chicago Board Options Exchange, and they have an index which measures investor fear. Basically, it measures the level of volatility in the markets, buying and selling, and specifically how many investors are trying to buy insurance to protect themselves from stocks plunging in value. And it went absolutely off the roof. It was the biggest shoot up in volatility the markets have ever experienced. It actually went so high that it broke their algorithms. The computer algorithms that actually calculate the fear in the market shut down for 30 minutes. And investors all over the world were calling in saying, what's going on? We need to get pricing on insurance. And it was out. It just knocked it out. That's how dramatic Monday was.
So what does this tell us? What's the larger conclusion that we can draw from this? With the volatility being off the charts, something is happening in the markets that's unprecedented.
Absolutely. Investors know, especially the big money, the smart money on Wall Street, not the mom and pop retail investors, but the big money, people who are handling billions of dollars a day, know that this market is in a very precarious position. And for example, debt underpinning the market, the leverage, the amount of leverage in the market is at unprecedented levels. We've never had so much debt in the market. You hear tons of talk about how American corporations are filled up with cash. They have cash on their balance sheets. And that tends to lend people confidence in a market. But it's a total lie. If you take a look at where they're getting that cash from, it's because they've gone out in the market and they borrowed that money and they put the cash on their balance sheet. So yeah, they have access to cash. They can do things with cash. But everybody forgets the other side of the equation. They have that cash because they went out and they borrowed it. So there's massive amounts of debt that underpin this market. And then if you want to multiply that, you can take a look at investors in the market and how much leverage they're using to invest. Borrowed money, money they're borrowing from their broker to go out and buy stocks. And that too is at or near record level. So it's like compounding debt upon debt, and it's building this edifice that's supporting the stock market. And let's not forget, probably the biggest fundamental boost to the stock market after the crash in 2008, 2009. I mean, that was the Federal Reserve coming in and slashing interest rates to virtually zero, something they had never done in history before, to open up the debt spigots to get people out there borrowing and spending money. And a lot of that debt has gone into the stock exchanges. And it's not just the Federal Reserve either. You can take a look around the world. The European Central Bank did the same thing. The Bank of England has done the same thing. The Bank of Japan has done thing. And now most recently, we've seen the same thing coming out of China, where they're panicking because of their markets. And their central bank has been slashing interest rates, loosening borrowing requirements. So investors in China can use their house as collateral now to buy stocks. I mean, this is how I'm worried some of these policymakers are.
And once they've taken those measures, they can't take them again. Once interest rates are zero.
Right. Where are you going to go from zero? Like, are we going to get, I mean, that's what a lot of, Janet Yellen has been talking a lot about raising interest rates, trying to get back to normal. And it's been pushed back and been pushed back and been pushed back because
it
things
would have
aren't improving.
Catastrophic immediate effects, wouldn't it, to do something like that?
That's what a lot of people argue, because we are so dependent on debt and at every level in our society. Just forget the stock market. At a personal level, at the state level, at local levels, we're so dependent on debt. Raising interest rates could be very, very detrimental to the economy. And that's why they've been so hesitant to do it. And people are actually now saying that she might have to reverse herself on her stance of raising interest rates at the end of this year or pushing off to next year, and maybe actually announce another round of quantitative easing if the stock market keeps going the way it's going.
So with as much risk as there is for these investors, and you're talking about the big money investors, I'm just wondering what happens now.
Right. That's the big question. Mohammed Al-Erian from PIMCO, the biggest bond fund traders in the world, was out this morning talking about that. And he was saying he was trying to encourage investors that, you know, this market sell-off still isn't, you know, panic time. It's still in a healthy market correction type thing. But I'm pretty sure that he would be expecting people to be plunging into the bond market, especially sovereign bond market. So big markets like the United States or Germany or Japan. But this time it might even be different there, because we're living now in a world where central banks are printing money like crazy. And when you print money, it devalues the value of that money. So do people really want to lend money to these governments to get paid back in money that is being depreciated? So investors are in a conundrum, and they're looking for an alternative to the traditional safe havens. And I think, you know, one thing we saw happen on Monday was investors turned to gold as an option. Precious metals. We saw that for the last 3 years, gold has been in a downtrend. And then suddenly on Monday, it firmed up and seemed to have reversed direction. So it's interesting. We know investors are out there just looking for any savior they can find.
It seems all of this, the volatility within the market, the fact that investors would be looking for somewhere safe to put their money, it would suggest that there could be dramatic changes in the global economy in a very short amount of time if something emerged to provide that kind of haven for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Confidence in the system, the current system right now, is just hanging by a thread. Everywhere you look, people are worried. I think evidence of that was in that fear index gauge is blowing through the roof so quickly after you know it had been fairly steady for a while. Investors don't know what to do, and they are looking for that alternative.
So a lot of people out there are saying, what do I do with my money? What kind of answers do you have?
Well, you know what? There are no good answers. There just are not any good answers into today's environment, because everything is so manipulated. The central banks around the world have destroyed all the standards. They are now printing money, something that has never happened in history. We're in a zero rate interest rate environment. There aren't a lot of good answers to that. I think if you look to the Bible, there are some principles in the Bible that help people with that. I mean, obviously, where we're headed with this, your ultimate protection isn't going to come from, you know, any investment that you can make. But for example, Book of Proverbs talks about diversification, different things along those lines, making sure you have a rainy day fund, making sure all your eggs aren't in one basket. I think there's some very sound principles that you can base your finance on to help you weather these kind of storms. But carried to the extreme, there's no way out from what could be headed here shortly.
Looking at things from a standpoint of biblical prophecy, how do we see this, playing out and fulfilling some of the major prophecies of the Bible ahead?
Yeah, we are heading into some very, very interesting times, and prophecies that we've been looking for and expecting for years appear now to be very, very close. We know from Bible prophecy to expect the United States and Britain to continue to experience these financial problems that are hitting us, and they're only going to get worse. And we know from Bible prophecy that the world's finances, the world's financial system, will not be revolving around the United States forever. And there will be a new system that will replace the United States. And that's going to be, despite all the problems in Europe right now, we're starting to see Europe come together in a way that they have never done before. They're addressing problems in a way they've never addressed them before. And Bible prophecy indicates that that's where the next economic superpower will be located for a short period of time. It will be in Europe. Bible also talks about the rise of Asian powers, and they will be rising as well. And for a period of time, they will be working very closely in Europe. And those are the trends we need to watch. We need to watch these economic problems intensify in the United States, and we need to watch Europe come together to solve its problems.
And it sounds like even China, that we wouldn't expect this to be a long-term loss. From China's perspective, they would stabilize.
Right. I think what's going on in China, some of it has been overblown. Their stock market has corrected a lot more.
In terms of the way it's been reported.
Their stock market has corrected a lot more. But remember, They've been growing so quickly over there. Their stock market has gone up so fast over there.
There's bound to be some bubbles. And
absolutely there is. But look at what's been happening in this world. Commodity prices have just been collapsing through the floor. If you look at oil prices, they're down below $40 a barrel. Remember, a year and a half ago, they were up above around $100 a barrel. Virtually every commodity you look at, it's been plummeting. And those things are because world trade is slowing down, the global economy is slowing down, China has been slowing down. But remember, when these commodity prices come down, who does that benefit the most? It benefits China. So the seeds of China's recovery are in the collapse of these commodity prices. So the cure for these low commodity prices are the low commodity prices, because China will benefit from them, their industry will benefit from them, and in the end, it'll help them become stronger.
Very interesting stuff. Robert Morley has written an article on thetrumpet.com. It's called Fear Index Explodes as World Careens Towards Global Market Meltdown. Check it out on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Robert, for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Road Back to European Power. That was the title of a paper published last month by the European Council of Foreign Relations, an influential European think tank. Now, anyone who ever heard the prophetic message of Herbert W. Armstrong would recognize a lot of what is written in this paper as consistent with what he forecast about Europe for decades. We talked about this paper a week or so ago with Richard Palmer, our trumpet writer in the United Kingdom. I wanted to follow up with him about it. He's here with us now. He's written an article on thetrumpet.com called The Europe of the Bible Takes Shape, with the subhead, The Europe You See Emerging Today Increasingly Matches the Europe Forecast by Herbert W. Armstrong. So, Richard, we talked before a bit about the way that this think tank describes America's role in the world. That's obviously very prophetically significant. But I wanted to get into some of the other items that you discuss in this article. First of all, there's this section in here about its approach toward Africa. Obviously, there are a lot of threats in Africa that are emerging within Africa, that and these influential thinkers in Europe are trying to figure out what can we do to address and to counter some of these threats within Africa. Can you tell us why this is so significant?
Yes, there's a number of different ways. The most obvious that we see right making headlines right now is, of course, Europe's migrant crisis. And that's something that we talked about just last Friday. And Africa is a large part of that. A lot of these are coming from Libya and further south. And really, Africa is a battleground between European powers and radical Islam. And this is something that the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, drew attention to back in 2013. And he had a couple of articles, I think, back to back, one month after the other, in the Philadelphia Trumpet, talking about how Iran has designs on being the strongest power throughout the region and is extending its reach through North Africa. And then he said, but Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. And now, when you look at this paper that we're about the road to European power, probably the place that they are most assertive and most aggressive is when it comes to talking about North Africa. And they even make calls for Europe to start getting much more involved militarily. They talk about how aid gets less and less return for Europeans giving it. They're competing with China, who gives aid with many fewer strings attached. And so they talk, and then they talk about how just funding UN military missions isn't very successful in bringing the continent under control. And so they say, while many European governments are instinctively wary of sending their own troops to Africa, the convergence of humanitarian crises and terrorist threats on the continent is changing their calculations. And then it talks about how France led the way in intervening in Mali and the Sahel, and you got all these other European countries involved. It notes Europeans still have greater security assets in Africa than China. And so it goes on to recommend that Europe work together and have all their militaries work together to maximize their military power within North Africa. And this is right in line with what Mr. Fleury was writing about in 2013.
So the primary point that Gerald Fleury brought out was that he's looking at, say, European designs on Northern Africa primarily as a means of countering the rise of Iran. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I think that's definitely still on Europe's radar. And I think in a lot of ways, the migrant crisis is also tied to the rise in Iran.
Well, it almost seems like, say, some of the issues that they're having with Northern Africa, and particularly just the threat that is being posed by this flood of migrants, as we were talking about last week, it's almost giving them an opportunity, or it's kind of forcing the issue for them to address some of these maybe larger issues that they would not be as inclined to be as say, upfront about.
Yes, exactly. And dealing with the migrant crisis and dealing with Iran, the way you do that is pretty much the same thing. You have to tackle the people causing the instability. Who's causing the instability? It's radical Islam, radical Islamic terrorists that are usually funded and backed by Iran. And so it all comes down really to the same thing in the end. But helping migrants is a much more nicer way of marketing it.
The quote that you put in your article from this paper where they're talking about the importance of dealing with these humanitarian crises and it requiring a more robust military intervention on Europe's part. What I wonder is, another prophecy that we have talked about is just the potential for Europe to grow into a significant economic superpower and extending its reach into Africa more as a resource grab and as a way to fuel the requirements of the kind of empire that we expect them to build. Is there anything in this paper that kind of speaks to that point as well, or is it really more focused on dealing with security threats?
I think it's more focused on dealing with security threats, more because a military response in order to grab resources is a tougher sell. It doesn't sound as nice or as friendly. And I believe it was a German president had to resign after making comments along those lines that Europe should act militarily to secure resources. So if that argument...
Europe's not ready for that yet. And yet it,
exactly. I think a lot of people at the top believe that, but it's not the kind of thing that's easy to come out and say in public at the moment.
Well, what's interesting is it seems like China is conducting itself in a way that seems more willing to make those kinds of assertions, that it's much more nakedly interested in the resources within Africa than what Europe seems to be.
True, though I think Europe is much more concerned about concealing what they're doing, not in a top secret way, but just in a way of using international agreements and long acronyms and this kind of thing. When you start to look into Europe's economic relationship with Africa, they are being quite aggressive in the way that they're trying to push the various African or different African groups together into trading blocks and then forcing these trading blocks to have very favorable terms in terms of trade with Europe. So they are doing it, but they're doing it Europe's very good at using international institutions in almost the battle of the peace in its favor. And so it's going about the resource grab in Africa in a very different way to China. And it's less a case of we need this resource, we're going to get it, we're also going to send soldiers in, or we're going to give you aid in exchange for this resource. It's much more about trade talks and talks with this regional bloc and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting that this think tank notes that Europeans still have a greater security asset, greater security assets in Africa than China has. As aggressive as China is being, it's still very much within Europe's strategic calculus that they need the resources that Africa has on offer. Looking, say, a little further north and into the Middle East, what are some aspects of the paper that kind of raise your eyebrows prophetically in terms of prophetic significance with respect to the Middle East?
Yeah, I think the paper makes some very good points on the Middle East. What it does, I think, is it gives a very good description of the situation now. Then it has what it thinks Europe should do And that differs from really the direction Europe's taking at the moment and what we know prophetically. But there is a lot of value in its description of what the case is now. So just to illustrate that, it talks about how the Saudi-aligned Gulf Cooperation Council has direct and funded arms purchases from France, for instance, that add up to around 14 billion euros so far in 2015. And so he talks about that. It talks about that close military link you get between France and a number of other European countries and that Saudi alliance. And we know from Bible prophecy that Europe is prophesied to be aligned with the Sunni Saudi bloc in the Middle East.
Which speaks to what you were saying about the strategy to counter Iranian influence as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the paper goes on to recommend a different strategy. It suggests not taking a side in the Iranian-Saudi split. But as I said, it notes that a lot of Europe is taking a side in that right now. And we know from prophecy that that's just going to continue.
We're talking with Richard Palmer about a European Council of Foreign Relations paper called The Road Back to European Power. Several aspects of this paper that align with prophecies about Europe's future that Herbert W. Armstrong made decades ago. Another aspect of the story that you wrote on this concerned Europe's relations with Asia, and particularly Russia and China. The aspect of this with China, this is actually a prophecy that we've been highlighting more recently. Can you tell us about the Europe-China relationship and how this paper speaks to that?
Yeah, the Europe-China relationship is a big story that I'm sure we'll have an article on in its own right at some point over the next few weeks. They note the shift in the international order, and they say nothing symbolizes the shift in international order better than China's successful Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank proposal, which won the support of 56 nations, among them 14 European member states. And Mr. Rob Morley has written quite a bit on this bank. It's a rival to the World Bank, and it's very interesting that Europe has been very supportive of this and publicly broken with the United States. And over the last few months, we've seen a growing and increasing trade relationship between Europe and China. And China's put a lot of effort into this over the past few months. They've made some pretty major developments on their new Silk Road initiative and their initiative to set up a chain of ports as well, leading from China to Europe. And that's one of the big stories of the first half of 2015, is this increasing trade relationship between Europe and China. And this is something that Mr. Flurry wrote on, and Mr. Fraser also, then.
Ron Fraser, the late trumpet writer. Yeah, obviously very closely connected to these activities.
Yes, and he drew attention to what Mr. Flurry had written and showed how it was being fulfilled back 5 years ago or more. And we're seeing a continuation of that and just an intensification of a trade relationship here, and a trade relationship that cuts out the United States, which was one of the major prophecies of Mr. Armstrong. And they're really forming a whole new set of institutions and new ways of doing business that do not include the United States. And if you have Europe on board with that, if you have China on board with that, then you have a major percentage of global trade going outside of American circles into a rival commercial system. And so we see the very early stages of that rival commercial system being built right now between Europe and China.
We've talked about this Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank just being one of the most dramatic symbols of this effort of major powers, economic powers, to create an economic world, a center of economic power that is contrary to or opposed to or separate from the United States. And the fact that Europe jumped on board with that and is really throwing its weight behind China, assuming that kind of a role, it's really remarkable and could have dramatic implications as far as the future of the world economy.
Yeah, and just as this paper brings out, it's a potent symbol as well. The fact that Europe was able to ignore some really strong, or felt they could, or decided to ignore some really strong protests from the United States to go ahead with this.
So the specific prophecy that you draw attention to here, the Great Mart, that's a prophecy in Isaiah?
Yes. And I believe that's talked about in in our Isaiah booklet about this great mart that includes Europe, that includes China, and that cuts out the United States.
One final point that you bring out in here is the relationship between Europe and Russia. That's obviously something that we've been watching closely and drawn attention to several times because, again, of specific biblical prophecies that show European response to Russia's rise. How does that factor in this think tank's paper?
Well, really, the prophecies, you have have two separate dynamics in Europe's relationship with Russia. We have the one that's kind of similar to Europe's relationship with China in an interest in working economically with other major powers to form an economic system that cuts out the United States. But on the other hand, it's very clear from those prophecies that Europe has a real fear of Russia and that they're very concerned about what Russia is doing. Those talk about how ultimately this fear of Russia provokes Europe into a preemptive strike against Russia and their allies in Asia. And you see both these dynamics talked about in this paper as well and see them clearly in the world today. On the one hand, Germany and the economic powers of Europe want a strong trade relationship with Russia. And on the other hand, there is a huge fear of Russia, especially within Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet states. And so you have this kind of, it's complicated relationship with Russia where they want to get on for now. Germany doesn't want to draw too close so that it alienates potential allies such as Poland. And at the same time, doesn't want to go too far away so it doesn't reap all the benefits that it can get through economic cooperation with Russia and even in some aspects a strategic alliance in Russia, as they do have some goals that align.
I just want to conclude by reading a few comments from the very beginning of your article. More than 70 years ago, Herbert W. Armstrong gave a series of very clear and dramatic forecasts of where world events are leading since his death. Gerald Fleury has continued issuing the same warnings more than ever before. Here's just kind of the big picture of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Those warnings are becoming reality. Germany dominates Europe, and the continent is on its way to becoming a superpower, just as Herbert Armstrong forecast 70 years ago. I think anyone who is at all familiar with what he wrote about and spoke about consistently over decades has to be amazed to see those things coming to pass. Your article, other forecasts are also being fulfilled. The growing Russia-Chinese friendship is all over the news. America's decline is clearly visible, but it was always Europe that was central to Mr. Armstrong's warnings. It's just remarkable to see these statements coming out of this think tank, what's on the minds of some of the leading thinkers in Europe, and giving us an idea of just how these forecasts are coming to reality and how they're going to unfold within Europe in the time ahead.
And we're talking about really a fairly narrow slice of those forecasts and of what's going on in Europe. You know, we're just confining ourselves to Europe's foreign policy. There are a whole load of other things that Mr. Armstrong is being dramatically proved right. And you've got the Euro crisis is another major way. And there's so many specific prophecies within that, and just writing some of these articles over the past month or so is just, you know, I've always grown up with Germany being a major power in Europe the whole of my adult life. It's been that way. And it's really given me just a new appreciation of what a dramatic call it was to forecast this when Germany was in rubble and just what dramatic changes we've seen over the past 20 years and how that is right in line with what Mr. Armstrong said. And you'd really hope that people that heard that, what he was saying 20, 30, 40 years ago would be sitting up and taking some serious notice right now.
We have a booklet called He Was Right, where we have collected the most dramatic of these forecasts Mr. Armstrong made over a period of over 50 years and then showed how these forecasts are coming to pass in the news today. We really tried to take a comprehensive approach. Europe is the first chapter, probably the biggest chapter or one of the biggest. But you see similarly fulfilled prophecies within the Middle East, within the Anglo-American world, within the Asian sphere, and in elsewhere in the world. It is exciting to see these things come to pass. We certainly appreciate you bringing this paper from this European think tank to our attention, the European Council of Foreign Relations. And appreciate your time in explaining this to us, Richard. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Good to be here.
Talking with Richard Palmer, the title of his article, The Europe of the Bible Takes Shape. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour.
A new addition to the KPCG lineup starts next Tuesday, September 1st at 8 a.m. It's called Live by Every Word. That is a quote from Jesus Christ in Matthew 4 and verse 4. He said, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." This is a half-hour program once a week. It'll be hosted by Brian Davis. I have Brian here in the studio with me. How are you doing? You excited?
I am. Yes, very much so.
So why live by every word? What is it about that phrase that you feel is compelling?
Well, that's direct instruction from Jesus Christ himself, God's own son. And he tells us to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And if Christ says to do something, then we should do it. But how can someone do that if they don't know what those words are? So the idea is to get into God's word and see exactly what those words are that we're supposed to live by. Everybody has their ideas. People have been told all sorts of different things. You know, we have 34,000 different denominations in Christianity, and everyone interprets things differently. And the idea is to get into God's word and actually see what it says. What does it really say? And only then can you actually live by it.
So it seems like you're kind of aiming this at the person who has a fundamental respect for what the Bible says. There are obviously a lot of people out there that would say, you know, well, it's not really that trustworthy. What we have today, it's only, you know, it's a copy of a copy or that type of thing. But you're basically, the premise of it is, if it's in there, it's something that we can put our trust in.
Well, I think initially, I think someone who already has a certain respect for the Bible, they would get more out of it to begin with. But I also intend to hit those that maybe don't believe in the Bible. And we can get into this and see that there is great credibility and great authority in what is actually written in the Bible. And even people who are skeptics, I can understand why they are skeptics when they hear and see all of the chaos in religion today. And the frankly, some of the crazy things that people say about the Bible and about Jesus Christ and about religion in general, I can understand why they're skeptical. And I would like to be able to prove to those people, just looking at the Bible and seeing what it really says, that a lot of the things that they have heard, some of their preconceived ideas because of what they've been taught growing up or what they've seen on television or what they've heard from ministers, you know, from all different denominations, I would like them to listen as well and to see that a lot of the reasons that they believe the Bible is foolishness, it's really just foolishness out of the minds of men. It's not foolishness out of the Bible. So I think it's a message for those people who have a respect for the Bible, but also for a lot of other people who just don't know anything about the Bible. They know what other people have said about it.
Could you give us an example of, say, something where you feel like a common misconception about the Bible that someone would hold on to that would prejudice them against the teaching of the Bible? If they understood this, then it would challenge that assumption or that misapprehension.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is there was a commentator recently I saw, and he was being interviewed, and he has a lot of negative things to say about the Bible and about religion in general. And he had an audience of probably, oh, I would say 200 or 300 people. And he was up at the front of the room, and there was someone else interviewing him. And he would just throw out these dogmatic statements. And one was, he said, well, the Bible says that anyone who doesn't keep Sunday should be murdered. And everyone just nodded their heads and agreed with that. And the Bible doesn't say that at all. It doesn't say that at all. And he is talking about some Old Testament laws in a theocracy, a sovereign individual nation that had criminal justice laws. It was a theocracy, so it had certain laws there. But they don't know what they're talking about at all. The Bible doesn't command you to keep Sunday, and it doesn't command us to go out and murder people who don't keep Sunday. And so people can just throw these things out there. That's one example, and we can dig into those things and actually see what God actually does say and what his aim is in all of the things that he actually says, and what he said before there was an ancient nation of Israel that was a theocracy, what he said during that time, what he has said since. We can go into all of those things and just prove what it does say and what it doesn't say. Another one would be where people think that they've been taught that they either give their hearts to Jesus, and if they do, they're going to float around in the sky on clouds and just gaze into his eyes, or else they're going to burn in some hot pit of lava. And a million years from now, they're no closer to the end of that torture than the day that they began. And their grandmothers are up in heaven floating around looking down on them suffering. You know, things like that would cause people to say, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. How can there be a loving God that would say, if you don't keep Sunday, you should be murdered, and if you don't do this, you're going to burn in this hot lava pit forever and ever? Those types of things would cause anyone to say, I don't believe in a God like that. I don't believe in the Bible if that's what it says. And the fact of the matter is that's not what it says. And so we want to get into these things. And there, believe me, there are a lot of subjects that we can get into that will cause people to learn what actually is every word that has proceeded out of the mouth of God, and what are words that have only proceeded out of the mouths of men.
Those two examples that you gave, on one hand, you have, say, critics of the Bible who are trying to cast aspersions against it and to kind of ridicule these ideas as a means of kind of pitching the whole of religion out, or the idea that, say, you would have a worldview that's founded on this ancient book, and they would kind of throw the whole thing out. On the other, you would have maybe people who have been educated, maybe they've grown up in a religion and they've been taught certain ideas and never really challenged some of the assumptions that they made, and they have a sincere belief in some things that don't necessarily add up or equate with what's in the Bible itself. Basically, you're saying you want to help all of these people to see what we're actually talking about and how do the words of Jesus Christ actually measure up against some of these erroneous ideas that you have floating around.
Well, sure. The common idea of the Christian world, whether it's Catholicism or Protestantism, they essentially say that Jesus Christ came and did away with the law. And yet in Matthew 5 and verse 17, Jesus Christ said, "Think not that I came to destroy the law and the prophets being the writers of the Old Testament." We need to know. We need to know. Well, why did Jesus Christ say, "Don't think this"? And why do so many people say to think that? It's really crazy, and people are just deceived. They don't know. They don't know really how to study the Bible, because it is a jigsaw puzzle. It's almost like looking at a puzzle in a box, and nothing is put together, and it makes no sense. But when you begin to pull out a piece here and a piece there, the great prophet Isaiah even wrote about the fact that you have to take line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. That's how you have to study the Bible to really understand it. And so many people just flop the Bible open, and whatever page it lands on, they start reading, and they have no idea the context, who it was written to, when it was written, why it was written. They don't understand that. Other people begin at the beginning and just think that you just read straight through it. And yet Isaiah said, well, if you're going to understand this, it's line upon line, here a little, there a little, precept upon precept, and that's what we're going to do is actually get in there and see, well, now, wait a second. People have said Christ came and did away with the law and the Old Testament, and yet Christ himself said in Matthew 5:17, do not think that I came to do that. And he goes on and says, I actually came to magnify the Old Testament, to magnify the writings of the prophets, to magnify the law. And if anyone is doubtful as to which law he's talking about, he goes on and says, you've heard that you're not supposed to murder someone. Well, I tell you, if you even hate someone, you've broken that law. You've heard you shouldn't commit adultery. Well, I tell you, if you even look upon a woman and lust after her, then you've broken that law. Does that sound like he did away with those Ten Commandments? Or does that sound like he magnified those to where it includes more than just the letter of the law? It also includes the spirit of the law.
So you're talking about understanding the correct doctrine, say, with respect to something like what happens after you die. Do we go to heaven? Do we go to hell? But you're also talking about lusting after a woman or hating your neighbor. And these are more kind of like principles of living. I mean, the title of the program, Live by Every Word. What would be, say, other types of, you know, this is something that I have to do differently in my life if I'm really going to be living by every word. What kind of topics would you be covering in that respect?
Well, we have so many social issues today that are plaguing us politically and otherwise. And you have child rearing issues. You have school issues, interaction between neighbors, races, sexes. There are all sorts of problems plaguing society and plaguing us in our own homes. Obviously, we'll get into that. I mean, if you look at Adam and Eve, look, they had those problems. You know, Cain, their first born son, killed Abel, their second son. There was hatred there. There was violence. Something was wrong in their marriage. Something was wrong in the child rearing. And the results were horrible. We see those same results today. And all the way over in the New Testament, you see the Apostle John writing about that. He's saying, well, look, we need to learn from that. Don't be like Cain, who hated his brother and murdered him. And then he asks the question, why did he murder him? Why? Those questions are asked. The writers of the New Testament asked those questions. How many people know that they asked those questions? How many people know that it's not just some little story that you hear about in Sunday school, you know, when you're 5, 6, 7 years old, but they actually are recorded for us by God so that we learn from that. And it really would solve our problems in Ferguson or in Baltimore. Look at Charleston. Look at how that entire situation was so much different than how things transpired in those other cities.
Specifically because of a biblical approach.
Because they followed those biblical examples. You can tell that those people actually are striving to live by the words that they read in the Bible. And that's to their credit.
And when you say live by every word, so many of the examples that you're giving are Old Testament examples. There are a lot of people that the Bible is kind of the book of Psalms, book of Proverbs, and the New Testament and throw everything else out. But you're talking about how to apply even the principles that you see in the early books of the Bible, even the laws in the Bible.
Well, of course, I mean, the New Testament, people who want to say, well, we read the New Testament and we don't read the Old Testament, the New Testament, I believe it's about 25% of the New Testament are quotations from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And then other people say, well, we only live by the words of Jesus Christ, the words in red in the Gospels. Well, Jesus Christ continually went back and quoted the Old Testament. He especially quoted the book of Deuteronomy, which most people just are appalled by, you know, looking at that old law, as they say. And so, again, we get back to the point that most people simply don't know the Bible. They know that Christ said, live by every word, but they don't know what those words are. And I'm not saying that to condemn anyone or to ridicule anyone. It's just simply a fact. How many people really know what the Bible says? And so we want to get into that, and we want to get into doctrine and prove what the Bible actually says about this doctrine or that doctrine, but also how to live, how to get along with neighbor, how to get along with your mate, how to raise children, you know, how to have productive, happy, abundant lives. Christ said in John 10 that he came so that we could have life and that we could have life more abundantly. And if we actually live by what he said and what he taught, if we can learn it and understand it, then we will live life far more abundantly than most people are doing today.
Well, Brian, you're an excellent teacher. I think the program just sounds very enlightening, thought-provoking, challenging some of the assumptions that we make. Really looking forward to hearing it. The program's name is Live by Every Word. It starts next Tuesday, September 1st. It debuts at 8 a.m., and it's going to air a few other times during the week on this radio station, but it'll also be available online on demand at kpcg.fm or at thetrumpet.com. Really looking forward to it. Thanks for explaining it to us, Brian.
Thank you very much.
It's time for today's last word.
The English word cleave is quirky. Webster's defines it to adhere firmly or closely, or loyally and unwaveringly. But it also defines it exactly the opposite, to divide by, or as if by a cutting blow. So one of the first biblical commands regarding marriage is found in Genesis 2 and verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. A husband and wife must cleave in the first sense, that is, because if we don't, then in effect we cleave our marriages in the opposite way. What does God mean when he tells us to cleave? The Hebrew word means to cling or adhere, to catch by pursuit. Elsewhere in the Bible, the same word is translated abide fast, follow close, be joined, pursue hard, and stick. In the midst of life's hubbub, actively cleaving to your spouse in love doesn't happen accidentally. So many concerns can compete for your attention. Children, work, friends, church, chores, errands, bills, diversions, not to mention your relationship with God. How often, at the end of the day, do you crash the moment your head hits the pillow and neglect spending time cleaving to your spouse, not just physically, but spiritually, mentally, emotionally? It doesn't take much neglect to go from cleaving to merely coexisting. One flesh is what God wants in marriage. Oneness in sharing your thoughts, attitudes, emotions, bodies, and the physical things in life. After the workday, outside responsibilities and interests can continue to pull you away from each other if you're not careful. Television or other entertainment typically shuts down communication and can end up being a crutch that gives an illusion of togetherness, but actually cleaves your marriage in the wrong way. Husbands, is your heart at home with your wife? Your heart, is that where your primary interest lies? The answer to that question can help you determine how well you are cleaving to her. Remaining truly faithful to your wife requires deep mental, emotional, and psychological attachment. Spend time cleaving. Share your life. Read together. Listen to music together. Take walks together. Talk together, do things together, study the Bible together, rekindle the flames of romance that drew you together, court each other, get a babysitter for your children, and go out for a date, and not too infrequently. With planning and effort, you may even be able to take short trips alone, 2 to 3 days long, 2 to 3 times a year. How is your communication? A couple should have more to talk about together the longer their marriage lasts. If you're making a vigorous effort to cleave, then your common interests and your ability to relate will grow with time. You'll feel close emotionally, and your shared understanding, your affection, will make your marriage a joy. Sadly, for many marriages, a mountain of mutual effort is required to restore the relationship to a truly healthy state. If the idea of cleaving in the way that I'm talking about seems overwhelming, that's a good indication you and your mate would benefit from some marital counseling. A happy marriage is not only one of life's greatest blessings, it does much to help us overcome our selfishness and to learn the great joy of living the give way of life. Investing abundantly in your marriage isn't just a nice way to pass the time. So become a cleaver. Practice the art of cleaving in the right sense. Cleave to your mate. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can also get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We can take your thoughts or your questions if you email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. You can also find us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Also on Facebook and Google Plus if you search for The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Richard Palmer, and Brian Davis, and also thanks to the technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Audrey Hepburn. If I get married, I want to be very married. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.